All right, you've got it on KHUM Garberville, Eureka, Arcata, streaming on the web at KHUM.com. And our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. It's our two-hour open to the community discussion. We are dealing with the topic of incest. This is a topic that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. That is probably why it is probably the number one underreported sexual assault there is. It just makes people uncomfortable to talk about it. With that said, we will be dealing with some uncomfortable things. If you are uncomfortable listening to it, we are going to be talking for the next 2 hours about this. And we will leave that to your discretion, whether you think it's appropriate for your children or not. I think it is, but you're the parent. Anyway, let us introduce our panelists. Of course, we'll start with my partner in this campaign for the past 16 years, Sherry Johnson. Say hello.
Hello.
Introduce yourself. Give a little background besides my partner.
I'm Sherry Johnson, and I am privileged to be the co-host for this 16 years. And in my day job, I am the Department of Social Work's field director at Humboldt State University, and the chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council.
Indeed.
To my left.
Tasha, introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Tasha Howe. I am a psychology professor at HSU. I specialize in family violence and developmental psychopathology, which is childhood mental illness often related to child maltreatment or sexual abuse. And we have a master's program in developmental psychopathology that I teach in.
All right. And Paula, no stranger to this campaign.
Hi, this is Paula Arrowsmith-Jones, and I'm with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team, and we are in a community-based organization that serves Del Norte and Humboldt counties and deal with the issue that we're talking about today on a regular basis.
All righty, and joining us to your left, we have got Don Davis, who we talked to Wednesday.
Absolutely.
So, well, just go ahead and just introduce yourself and explain who you are, your colleague here.
I'm Dawn Davis, and I actually work here at KXGO. I'm the program director and do the midday show, and I am a product of incest.
A survivor of it.
Yeah.
If you will. And spoke very plainly about that, and that conversation is archived at KHUM.com, and really appreciate you, first of all, talking about it. And sharing that, because it's a huge gift to anyone out there who has been through it and doesn't really know what to do at this point. A lot of people are silent about it for their whole lives. And for coming back and be part of this panel.
Thanks really, for having me.
It's terrific to have you know, caregiver, psychologist, and someone who's been through it. So we've got a very well-rounded panel.
But it makes a huge difference to have survivors and survivor voices.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I guess, I'm curious, I guess this would be for psychology or for treatment. Why is this so taboo? Why is this so not talked about? Why does this make people so uncomfortable? I mean, there's lots of things that should make people uncomfortable. You know, all domestic violence should make people uncomfortable. All forms of violence should make people uncomfortable. Why is this so over the top? Uncomfortable. Any of you can grab this.
Well, I think what we hear at Rape Crisis from a lot of survivors is that there's several reasons why the silencing is so great, and one of them is that that person cares about their family and perhaps loves that person who was abusive towards them, and has to contemplate all that it would mean to the entire family to reveal what's happening to them. So often the child is kind of forced into a protective role. I think the sense of betrayal, I think people are uncomfortable in general in the public thinking about that the people that are supposed to nurture us and help us grow in positive ways into our adulthood, for them to be the people that are causing this kind of harm, I think really frightens people. So I think those are a couple of reasons.
And sexuality itself is not something that is so comfortably discussed on an everyday basis. And so it's the sexualized nature of the violence and of the violation. There's a lot of shame that's generated, and it is. It's like a painful stimuli, and you don't want to go where the pain area is, mm-hmm. and you do everything you can to avoid that pain.
Yesterday, when I talked with Karen, one thing she brought up is that she actually completely forgot about it mm-hmm. for years. I mean, it was just expunged for her from her memory. And she said that she found this actually is a really common occurrence for people who go through something like this, that they actually just don't remember it, and then something triggers it and brings it up, and it's like, whoa! And she, for her, it was like a trickle of things started coming to the surface until it all was there.
Well, the literature actually talks about a form of amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, the way in which we protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's surviving. You know, as a child, it makes all the sense in the world, or for any person of any age, to have to distance themselves from something that's so hurtful. And that people often later in life, in different ways, so for some people it might come back slowly, and for some people rather suddenly, but as they're in a different place where they can start to deal with it on a conscious level. Because most people who have forgotten it, that doesn't mean they haven't been coping with it all those years. Just in a less conscious way.
It's not on the conscious level.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting about when kids experience sexual abuse is that if they're very young, for example, they may not consciously remember it like you or I would, but they store it in the limbic system of their brain. And so they have limbic memories, which could manifest themselves in anxiety, extreme fear, lack of trust of people, a sense of self-doubt. And so your brain is still remembering it, but you're not able to provide the context or the language to communicate it or talk about it. But it's still affecting you in most areas of your life, and you're trying to cope with it in the best way that you can.
Now, what is limbic memory for
the limbic system of your
brain?
The limbic system of your brain is the center that processes emotion, and interestingly, it also processes memories. So your emotions and your memories are stored in the same region of the brain. So when we're storing memories, they often have an emotionally laden content next to them. And so when you have an emotional experience, like someone you love violating you, you are storing that memory, but the emotions are also being stored at the same time. So if you're very young, you don't have the vocabulary, you don't have the context, you don't know how to talk about it, but you have the feelings of something not being right. And oftentimes, because kids are very self-focused, which we call egocentric thinking, they often think it's something wrong with them, that they did something bad, that the feeling is of ickiness about themselves, that I'm flawed, something's bad about me. And so those feelings are still there, even if someone as an adult says they don't consciously remember exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. Don, did you remember always what happened to you, or was it something that just did something?
I actually didn't have the luxury of forgetting. I spent a long time trying to forget, but didn't have that luxury. No, I pretty much remembered the whole time.
And that's actually a more common scenario with survivors, mm-hmm. is that they can't forget it, that they have nightmares, flashbacks, they have a lot of difficulty just coping every day with the memories that won't go away. So both of those things can happen. Dissociation of the memory and constant reliving of the memory are both very normal responses.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it's an interesting thing, because yesterday when we talked with Karen, she was talking about she was trying to figure out why she forgot something so traumatic in her life, and she mentioned a study of a whole busload of school children that were abducted, and a month later, half of them couldn't remember it.
I remember.
right.
The Chowchilla kidnapping in 1973, I think.
78, I believe.
78.
So to me, it's just an amazing reflection of the resiliency of human beings, and that children are able to survive terrible things, and not just survive it, but come through and manage their lives. And yes, they're struggling. They may be struggling and dealing with a lot of difficulties in trying to come through experiences like this. But it's just an amazing thing to think about the way our brains work and the way that our whole beings as humans work, so that there's so many different ways that people cope. And that's, I think, important for our listeners to really understand, is that all of these, as Tasha said, are normal, natural responses to terrible things that have happened to people. And someone they know, they may see it play out in one particular way. But regardless of the way that the person is coping, it's about surviving and gaining one's life.
One thing I'm curious about is why this generally, and this seems to be pretty common with most of the stories that I've looked at, why does it generally begin at such a young age?
Age four, in a lot of the...
It was four for you. Yeah. It was two for Karen.
Yeah, and in some of the YouTube clips that I was looking at, it was age four. Mm-hmm. No, it's...
Why is that? I mean, first of all, I can't wrap my brain around someone who would do this. That's a really hard one to wrap my brain around. But why at such a young age? Because there's just, sexuality is not there with a child.
I can't say that the research really shows that we know why people do it, but there are a lot of studies on correlations or things that are associated with it. And a lot of the people who do this have issues with not being able to have healthy sexuality with adults. Mm-hmm. And so they feel powerless, they feel unable to connect with people, they may have poor social skills, they may have some kind of mental illness, although most don't. So they violate someone that they know is a safe target, that will not tell on them, that also loves them. So they wrap the love and the threat of fear up with the violation, so they're sure not to get caught, and they're still able to continue what they're doing.
It is amazing how effective they are at not getting caught.
Well, and if you look at that they are often starting with children so young, and sometimes pre-verbal even, but often in that 2 to 4 year age range, then as that child is growing up, the silencing has been affected before they would necessarily have the opportunities or abilities to communicate. So it's really it's an effective strategy on the part of the perpetrator.
And developmentally, too, it's not till about age 7 where, there's a kind of concrete thing that's happening. Tasha, help me here if I get all kaflooey. But it's like, so children could be, you're imagining that. Oh, you're making that up. So, and that's...
Well, and that's what adults often prefer to think is true. Right. And the child may not be able to relate the facts. And let's keep in mind that perpetrators lie. So, for example, if they wanted to make sure that the child wouldn't be believed, they could put pieces of information into that child's thinking that wouldn't make sense to another adult listener. So, for example, where it happened or when it happened. And since the young child could be easily confused about time and space, those kinds of more abstract things, then the story that they're sharing becomes disbelieved by an adult that they might try to tell, because maybe the time doesn't make sense or the location doesn't make sense, and then the whole story gets discounted. So many children actually have attempted to tell, But the way that they've told hasn't been believed or understood by adult listeners.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that verbal skills are not at a young child's strong suit there. to be able to.
And they have their own.
They have their
They're
own.
They're different than ours.
Right. Right. But it's, you know, it's to be able to convey in strong terms, mm-hmm. you know, what happened in kid talk can sometimes be a little mm-hmm. hard.
Well, you know, I also think that, first of all, you know, the brain doesn't know the difference between a lie and the lie and the truth. I mean, you can lie to your brain and it's going to believe it. So, I
sure.
mean, at a very young age, when you don't have those skills to, you know, use your brain in a consciously decisive way, you will believe what you're being told. And I also think for the perpetrator that. Part of the thrill is the power of that secret, you know. They hold power, and that, and I think that people that do that are very insecure people on the inside, and this gives them a way, you know, to make them feel bigger and better and you know, empowering. It empowers them to have that control, to have that power, and the power is that secret. You know, the power that they control truthfully is that secret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's truly amazing, and this is the case with you, this was the case with Karen and so many people that have done some research on this, is how often the mother is in the dark about it. I mean, that's to be able to keep a secret, you know, from your wife that you're living with about something this huge is truly remarkable. I mean, that's remarkable.
I'm going to have to say that I think that part of that reason is because there's already been trouble in the marriage. And, you know, a lot of times the mother is just staying in the marriage for the children anyway. And you don't want to look at that bad part of it. I mean, it's bad enough that you're stuck in a marriage with somebody maybe that you don't like anymore, mm-hmm. which, you know, so you're not having those maybe relationships, normal, regular relationships with your spouse. And it's truly, I mean, as a parent myself, to think that one of my kids could have, you know, been a victim of, you know, incest or any other kind of child, you know, domestic violence of any kind is, you know, for a mother, that's like the biggest failure. And I mean, that's got it, you know, that's the biggest failure in the world. I know that my mom still has repercussions from her feeling that she is a failure in that manner.
And that she didn't protect you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you think that she did know on some level and just didn't want to know?
You know, I don't know. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I truly believe my mom did the best that she could. Now, that's my opinion. I have another sibling underneath me who can't stand my mother and blames her. But my sister is also now 49 years old and is still blaming my mother for her, you know, all of her adult problems. So, I mean, it's hard to tell. I think each person, it's different. But I don't think that my mom really had any inkling. You know, it's infathomable to think that to think that you have to consistently be thinking negatively about every single encounter and every single person.
Mm-hmm. And also keep in mind that when we were kids, it was even more taboo than it is today.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, back then, people didn't even have the language. They didn't have a radio show that Cliff does. You know, they didn't have the internet. They didn't have websites and pamphlets and 800 numbers. So back then, it was very easy to get away with it. And it still is in large part. But we have a lot more resources and knowledge now where mothers can at least have the language and at least know what something might be going on. So it's a lot more out in the open today where mothers, you know, 40, 50 years ago, they didn't know anything about this.
Sure, mm-hmm. absolutely.
And I would imagine that they're across the whole spectrum from those who really knew nothing all the way to those that are involved in some way, and many who were maybe not like you said, maybe couldn't allow themselves to know. So I think it's every person, and as Dawn shared, not only would each of those mothers be different, but then how each of the children who were surviving through that interpret the other parent's role, whether it's the mother or the father, mm-hmm. Someone who we would hope would be there in protection.
One thing that's different now, and I want to got to take a break, but we can talk about this a little bit when we get back from the break. One thing that's different now than there was back when we were kids is there are mandatory reporters of things. There's like, you know, teachers and health workers and folks like you go around to schools to talk to children about mm-hmm. what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. And I want to talk about that, how that's perceived and how you think that's working in just a moment. First, we've got to take a break. You've got it on KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. All right, you've got it on KHUM, and we are in the midst of our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, and we are dealing with the topic of incest. As we said, this is a subject that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. Paula, we were talking before the break about what North Coast Rape Crisis Team does in this community. You go around to the various different schools and talk with elementary school mm-hmm. children about, you know, in an appropriate way, about what's appropriate, what's inappropriate.
Right, we do. Of course, we offer a full range of intervention services and to children and families. But on the prevention side, we do go to schools, and we actually work with children as young as preschool. And where we come from on that is that that clearly it's adults' responsibility to create safety for children. It's not the child's responsibility. But we do think it can be helpful to children to be able to think about ways in which they might connect with safe adults, ways that things might be communicated. And basically, the program really centers with the really young kids around their right to their own body and their own thoughts and their own feelings. And so it's kind of a safety program in the sense of allowing children to have a voice. And as a part of the program, after a kind of interactive presentation, we have what we call talk time. And children, if they wish to, it's completely voluntary, can connect with one of us, one of the prevention educators who's also certified as a sexual assault counselor and advocate. And the children often disclose a variety of troubling situations in their lives. And sometimes those disclosures include things that would be reportable child abuse. And then we, of course, take appropriate steps to try to bring intervention in for that child. But I think that the one of the things we're trying to do is create communication between children and trusted adults at school and also trusted family members. So we also, in conjunction with the children's programs, do parenting workshops and trainings for staff and faculty at schools.
What kind of response are you getting from parents with regard to this?
Well, it's a scary,
probably varied.
Yeah, it's a scary topic. I think no one wants to think about the possibility of their child being hurt. And because of what people see in the media and have been exposed to in a variety of ways, people tend to think about child sexual abuse around stranger abductions. And of course, those happen. And I mean, just recently here locally on the news was a situation of a boy being approached and scared by somebody, and so who was trying to take him. So it was a very threatening situation. So we know that those kinds of things take place. It's just that the majority of the time, most of the time, when children are being sexually abused, it's by the people closest to them. And that, I think, is, it's easier somehow for people to think about the threat that's out there somewhere in the world and how they might protect their child from that. And it's more challenging to let in the realities that it actually could be that person that you trust very much, that you love, and that you would never think of in a million years as somebody that would hurt your child.
Do you, when you're talking to the children about this, you know, you're saying that sometimes lights go on mm-hmm. with these kids, that something is going on. Now, we've talked about the fact that the incest happens within the nuclear family. Often the father abusing the daughters or even sons. Dawn, in your case, yours was your grandfather and your father.
Correct.
Sometimes it's uncles. There's various different permutations of this. Is this correct?
They're starting to find in the research now that one of the biggest demographics is older brothers, and they hadn't really realized how many perpetrators were youth, teenagers, older brothers. And, of course, a lot of those boys have had sexual violation done to them, and then they are what we call abuse reactive, reacting to what happened to them and then perpetrating on younger siblings.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Now, with various different forms of violence, whether it be sexualized or other, what we generally see is that those who perpetrate it had it done to them before. But one thing I wanted to point out is that even if you are a victim of or a survivor of violence, it doesn't mean you will carry that forward. In fact, most don't, actually.
That's one of the things I stress to my students, because the statistics get interpreted in different ways. But so a lot of people who are perpetrators have been violated in their own childhoods, mm-hmm. but most people who were violated in childhood do not go on to violate other people. So you have to look at the statistics in both Absolutely. Directions. And so students often get confused about that and think that, oh, if it happened to me, I better not have children, or, I'm going to avoid working with children. I'm afraid that I might do that. But the chances are most people won't do it, especially if you're aware of what happened to you. You have the wherewithal to try to cope with it in a healthy way, and you really work on minimizing the control it has over your life. Most people survive very beautifully.
The nice thing is, and I mentioned this before, is that being human beings, that we have choice. We can choose one path or another. We're not programmed to go one way or the other. We may have some inclinations to go one way or the other, but we can actually choose to say, okay, this happened to me. This is where it's going to stop. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely a choice.
And, we have a great local resource in Gail Narum, who is the therapist who runs Narum & Associates, which provides treatment for court-ordered sex offenders. But she also works a lot with people who are challenging themselves around behaviors that may be leaning in that direction. And she works with people who have survived sexualized violence as well as those who have acted out and perpetrated. And I think it's really important for people, if there is a listener out there who is willing to look at their own behaviors that are harming someone else, that to give her a call and talk about it. Know that there are choices that you can make, and that no one is destined to be a perpetrator. And so, especially around youthful offenses, like when Tasha was mentioning the older brothers and other, could be cousins or whatever as well, older children who've been hurt, if there's intervention, effective intervention for those early, then there's a lot of reason to hope that they will not become lifetime perpetrators, and there's plenty of evidence of that. But if it's left untreated and without intervention, then that negative path that they've begun is likely to continue in some negative direction.
There seems to be like two ways that adults go when dealing with adversity, whether it be, I was poor and I wasn't allowed to go to school, so damn it, my kids are not going to be able to go to school either. I've seen that happen. Or, I couldn't go to school, but I'm going to make sure my kids get all the education they can. That same school of thought seems to be with, I went through this and boom, there you are too. Or, it ends here because this is, they're going to have a better life than I did. It seems like a selfish choice to bring it forward.
Well, you know, sometimes we hear from moms who maybe were at the hospital after a sexual abuse has been revealed about a child. And maybe there is a mom who's saying, well, I don't know why everyone's making such a big deal. I went through this. Nobody cared. And what we try to hear out of that is the hurt and loss that they've experienced and that wasn't responded to in an appropriate way. And acknowledge to them our regret that no one was listening to them or that no one did believe them, nobody heard their voice, and that now they can make a different choice and give a gift to their child that wasn't given to them. So sometimes just that, just knowing that, yes, it's true that not only were you hurt, but no one was there for you. And that doesn't mean that it has to play out the same way for your child. And sometimes you can actually see the person shift. But they need to have their own survivorship acknowledged first. Otherwise, it's not unusual for somebody to say, well, you know, too bad, this is just how life is.
Let me give out the phone numbers. This is, you know, we're here talking, but this is a community dialogue. And anyone listening who wants to call in, you know, share their thoughts, ask questions. You can give your name or you don't have to. You can call in anonymously. It doesn't matter. 786-KHUM. That translates to 786-5486. Or toll-free for Southern Humboldt, 923-7799. If you'd like to just email in a question or a thought or a comment, studio@khum.com will work as well. We've also got some little clips that Sherry has done a good job rounding up, and I think we may want to play some of those as well. But feel free to call right now. This would be a good time because we need to take a quick break. This is KHUM. All right, we're 20 minutes ahead of 9 o'clock. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. Incest is the topic of the day. That is what we're talking about. I think it's time we reintroduce the panel. I'm Cliff, obviously, from KHUM, and my longtime co-host of this campaign, Sherry Johnson.
Good morning.
And, well, just again, just give your credentials.
All right. I'm the Director of Field Education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and the Chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. And I also teach a class this spring called Ecology of Family Violence. It's a social work breadth course.
My name is Tasha Howe. I'm a professor in the psychology department at HSU. I specialize in family violence, and I'm also teaching a family violence class in the spring where we talk about animal cruelty, domestic violence, child abuse, and elder abuse. I specialize in children who have behavioral and emotional problems, oftentimes connected to child maltreatment.
And hi, I'm Paula Arrowsmith-Jones, and I'm with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team. And I'd like to give out our hotline
when
we have a chance, and that is 707-445-2881. And let people out there know if they have at any point in their life dealt with any form of sexualized violence, including child sexual abuse, that line is available and that all of our services are free and confidential.
And that's 24 hours a day.
24 hours, yes.
That's right. Dawn?
I'm Dawn Davis. I work here at KXGO, the program director, and do a midday show.
And you're a survivor of
incest. I am a survivor of incest, yes.
Right.
And then if you don't want to talk to anybody on the phone, there is, and you have access to a computer, there is a website called RAINN, RAINN. You can just Google RAINN, and that's the National Sexual Assault Hotline. And there's a lot of just incredibly helpful resources on that website.
Well, we've got audio from a YouTube clip that we want to play. You want to explain what we're going to hear?
Well, it is audio from a YouTube clip. It's a survivor talking about surviving her child sexual assault, incest experience, and domestic violence.
Okay. Well, we'll let it speak for itself, and we will, I guess, talk about it afterwards. It's on KHUM.
So I'll tell you a little bit about my journey through uncovering that I had become an incest survivor, or that I was an incest survivor, to where I am today. And I'll tell you that it's not an easy journey, and it is one that has lots of roadblocks and lots of obstacles, and that it is a journey that is definitely worth taking, because the end result is a wonderful life of your own choosing. When I got married, I suspected that I had been abused as a child, but I had buried it so deeply in myself that I just did not acknowledge that it was there. All of the signs certainly were there. I would not try anything. I was afraid to try anything. I had I had received a scholarship to go to university, felt that I was not worthy of going to university, so I chose not to go. I was afraid to leave the comfort of what I was doing. I was afraid of where that would lead me. I was afraid, quite frankly, of failure, but more importantly, of being successful. I didn't want to shine. I didn't want to be great in the world. I didn't want to be noticed. And that was one of the saddest parts of going through the childhood that I did, because we are all great people and we all do deserve to shine. And I just felt like I was tarnished, and I felt like there was no purpose for me to be great. So after I got married and had my children, it became apparent that this was going to be an issue as I started to see my children want to shine. And I wasn't allowing them to do that. I was struggling with how they were going to be these wonderful people that they were allowed to be, that they deserved to be, because I didn't know any better. I did not have the proper tools. I did not know what I needed to know in order to let these wonderful little creatures shine. And so I decided at that point that I needed to go through the therapy that I had to go through. I needed to go to the groups that I had to go to. I did a lot of reading. I talked to a lot of people. I did a lot of reflection, soul searching. And the bottom line on all of it was to forgive myself for thinking that way. That was a very big part of what was my healing, if you will. And I say the word healing, but I don't necessarily like to use that, because I don't think we're ill. I don't think there's anything wrong with us. I don't think that we have a problem. I think that we have been made to believe that we are less than, and we're not. So I say healing, and maybe that's not the right term. But I did a lot of work around that, and because I learned how to forgive myself, that was the very first step for me. I began to realize that I was doing things I was doing because of the things I was taught, because of the things that all around me had perpetuated all of those untruths in my life. It was my perspective on how I was seeing things.
And there you have it. That was, I guess, a self-published YouTube clip, which is quite a share for someone to do just on their own, just to say, you know what, I'm going to put my story out there, and maybe it's going to help some others. And it probably has. You know, it's got thousands of views, a lot of positive comments. So any, speaking of comments, any comments on what we just saw? Any of you?
Everybody turns to me. you know,
I think that I think it is very important to talk about it. And like I said, I think the biggest if you have been a victim of incest or any other kind of domestic violence, and I think it goes to any kind of domestic violence, yeah, whether it's mental, physical, or whatever. The first when I said that the power that they hold over you is that secret. Keeping it quiet continues to give that power. You're giving your power away. And believe that if you want your power back, the first thing is to talk about it. You know, part of not being able to heal is not being truthful with yourself. And I think that you have to be, you know, you have to get really deep down into being truthful about it. You know, I shared the other day how, you know, what empowered me was I was determined to show my family that I was going to be something, and I was going to, you know, prove them wrong that, you know, I wasn't, you know, not as good as everybody else. And, you know, that fueled me. And I was very fortunate that the majority of my family pretty much ignored me. So I didn't learn those things that, like, my child, I honestly have to say that I'm very, I can sit here and say that I have produced two children who are unbelievably productive citizens and have great careers in their lives and are, you know, very, very happy and successful people. And yet I divorced their father when they were young. You know, I've been married three times. I haven't quite figured out the, you know, my part of the journey is I'm still trying to see if I can ever get into that relationship on a long-term basis. But I'm honest with myself about that. You know, I know where, you know, my shortfalls are, and I know that it's always going to be a work in progress. So I think the first step is to take your power back and use your voice. And, you know, even if you just find one person to be your confidant in it as you go through your journey of learning, you know, who you really are, you know, and who you really want to be without the influence of other people telling you what you are, what you can do, you know, because you can do anything you want. You just have to choose to do it. And there's no wrong choices. There's just life lessons to be learned.
Yep. And I guess there's no way of undoing what happened. You can't.
No, you can't
undo it. It happened. It was there.
It's like any other tragedy, whether, you know, it's a hurricane or a tornado or a tsunami. The tragedy, the thing happened. It's what you do with it, how you use it, how you choose to learn from it.
What's next?
And the ultimate goal is to feel better. The acceptance part is part of that process. And I really loved what Karen said in her interview, that she felt worse at first when she was mm-hmm. going through the therapeutic process, and that it just hurts worse. And that's the reluctance to try to engage in that. But that once you get that out, you get that secret out, that then...
She re-engaged with the pain and then was right. able to move on.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of people that share their stories with us at Rape Crisis talk about that many of them relate to a specific moment in their life where someone listened and believed, and it didn't change anything about what had happened. And for some of them, the violence continued on beyond that time where they were telling somebody about it. But it's not only... Can a survivor make the choice to put words and voice to their experience, but are there people willing to hear it? And that kind of encouragement, even if the violence doesn't stop, people name often that really mattered to them. So I think that's important for all of us to keep in mind, that when somebody's trying to tell you about something that happened to them,
yep.
If you can be in that believing place, even when you don't really want to believe it.
Yeah, a true friend, you know, believes their friends. I mean, a true friend is there for a friend. I mean, anyone who would shy away from you for mm-hmm. if you were to share something like this really isn't a friend, I mean, to be honest. I mean, that's, you know, you're being open and honest with them, and they're going, who wants to hear this? Let's go get a pizza. And it's like, no, this isn't a friend.
Well, and I think for most of us, or maybe this is just me, I have different kinds of friends. Mm-hmm. And as a survivor myself, there are people that I can share my survivorship with, and they're going to be there and able to hear pain. And I have other people that I have a great time with.
Mm-hmm.
But... They've made it clear, and I understand mm-hmm. that there are limitations on sure. what they can hear. And so, you know, we all have different kinds of people in our lives, different levels of friendship,
sure.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess no matter what the thing is in someone's life, if they're uncomfortable with it, you know, it can make it a tough choice. And we do have someone calling in right now, so if you could put your headphones on, and we will go to line one. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Is this the radio station?
This is the radio station. You're live on the air.
Rick, did I win the tickets for the Pink Floyd?
I'm afraid you're calling the wrong station. Try again. All righty.
Okay.
I knew it.
Well, that was
such
funny.
Is going to happen with a live show.
Right,
oh,
right.
I wish I had tickets for Pink Floyd.
Well, he was brave enough to call.
Yes.
You know, I'd like to add that I think this is why this is so important that you talk about this with your children. I mean, I think that first of all, you know, I know that a couple of comments had come through from some listeners that they didn't want their children to hear this and whatever. And okay, I can understand not wanting to hear the depth of it. But what's really important is that children know what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, because the thing about it is when you are a person who buries it and you have to readdress it and then go through that pain again, you know, going through it a second time and at a much older age is going to be so much more painful than in the very beginnings of it, which is why I think it's so important that people know what it is. I mean, children should know what it is so that they know that it is wrong, and that if you do suspect it, talk to them. And if you can't talk to them, find somebody who can that maybe can get it out of them so that they don't have to grow up burying something and then having to readdress it later on in life. Because you know, it's like any other cancer. The earlier you get it, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. That is true. So, Paula, you deal with teachers. You actually, I guess, tell them to instruct them on, I guess, things to look for, and how to be a mandatory reporter. What do they look for? If you're a teacher and you've got kids in your class and they're just running around being kids, are there certain warning signs or something?
There can be. I think we more try to work with teachers rather than a list of signs.
Uh-huh.
It's more about being listeners.
Got it.
Being willing to engage, being willing to pay attention. A lot of times teachers have an instinct, kind of a gut feeling that there's something in that child's life, and they might not know what it is, but what they're seeing, the signs, in quotes, that people tend to see really reflect stress in the child's life, and you might not know exactly what that stress is coming from. Could be any number of traumatic things going on.
Absolutely. Could be a divorce, could be poverty, could be anything.
Right. Witnessing violence,
sure.
Or violence to themselves, losses, grief, lots of things. But I think that there are some teachers that are really skilled at paying attention and being willing to hear and understand what that child is revealing. But it's important to know that, for example, some adults tend to think of quote-unquote acting out behaviors. And a lot of times those are behaviors that bother adults for some reason. The kid is noisy. The kid is, you know, distracting others, whatever.
Wow, that sounds like a kid to me.
But what isn't always noticed is the child who's excelling, the child who makes sure that they do everything really well. Sometimes, achieving or overachieving is an outcome of a traumatic childhood experience. So every child is reacting differently. One of the things we do talk about is noticing big shifts or changes in the child, whatever the personality that you knew them as having. If you notice something really significantly change, that could mean something. But I think that kids reveal in lots of ways, and that we as adults have to work at being better listeners and better observers.
I think Paula makes an important point about the changes in behaviors, because you'll often asking about the signs and symptoms. It's really hard to know what's going on with the kids, as Paula said, but any change in appetite, eating way more, eating way less, changes in sleeping, sleeping way more, sleeping way less, nightmares, not wanting to be around people, a lot of withdrawal, not wanting to be around their friends, acting out as people might recognize more easily in anger, behavior problems, their grades are slipping. An obvious symptom is sexual behavior that's way beyond the average child of that age's years. So you might hear language about sexual acts. You might see public masturbation. You might see them wanting to look at people's genitals, you know, things mm-hmm. like that. So there are some warning signs, but we can't always assume that they were sexually abused. But really noticing that something is different about them could be a warning sign that you might want to investigate. But another important point about the mandated reporters is the research shows the majority of mandated reporters do not report. And that right. is something that's very important to think about, because they often think, if I report, something bad will happen to me, or they think that something bad will happen to the child that's worse than what the child's experiencing now, such as they might go to foster care, there might be a lawsuit. So mandated reporting as a policy is kind of controversial, because a lot of people are not reporting when it is their job to report.
Mm-hmm. And we notice that when we're in school, sometimes we'll be approached by school personnel, and they might say, oh, we're really glad you're here, because there's this child we're really worried about, and we're hoping that you'll make a report. And our first question is always, well, so have you made a report? You know, if they're the ones with the information. And but there's a lot of pressure on people working at schools not to report, actually.
And it looks like we've got another caller. So we'll put your headphones on. And hello, you're on the air. I guess you're not. Okay, fine. All right, while we're talking about phones, let me give out that phone number. If you wanted to call in, share a story, make a comment, ask a question, whatever it may be, as long as it pertains to our topic today, 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486, digitally speaking. Toll-free for Southern Humboldt, 923-7799. And since it is 9 o'clock, let's give the legal ID. This is KHUM, Garberville, Eureka, Arcata. Translator, K282AD. Eureka, it's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, our 16th. And this week we are talking about incest. That is the topic. Okay, we got the... Well, I thought I saw them calling back.
Yeah.
But maybe not.
Looked like it was blinking.
It was blinking for a moment.
Call back if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Could I add something in reaction to what Tasha was sharing? Because I think the sexually acting out aspect is really important for people to think about. If you're seeing something in a child, and as she said, like an awareness or of something that seems beyond the age that you would expect them to have that information. And it's kind of confusing these days, because children, sadly, are exposed to so much inappropriate material on TV, et cetera. And so people sometimes have a hard time sorting out, what does this mean that my child knows about this?
All right, so let's try again. Hello, you're on the air. This is KHUM. Hello. Okay, well, one of these days I've got to get a phone screener.
and if I could just finish then, the other thing about that is that a lot of adults are afraid to talk to children about sex. And about the fact that we're all sexual beings. And so that creates a barrier so that they can't engage in a conversation or even allow themselves to think about what is the natural way that children would explore their own body and have an understanding of sexuality versus those things where they might be acting out against another child, or they might be acting in ways that it would indicate that somebody has abused them. So we need to get more comfortable about talking about sex.
Absolutely. Well, perhaps third time's the charm. Hello, are you there? This is KHUM.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, you're live on the air.
Yeah, I like the conversation. I know it's a bit difficult, but it seems to be like an endemic situation within our culture where we're overstimulated, and then, you know, it acts out in unhealthy ways. And although I've never been a victim, I feel like oftentimes I'm seen as the perpetrator because so many women that I've come up against have been abused in one form or fashion, most often sexually by someone that they knew, a family member, a father. And it's still, a lot of that, so much of it's still in the closet, is what I believe. And now that I have a 15-year-old daughter, it's like, there it is, you know, there's this, I can see why the temptation exists. The taboo culture we've created just puts us up against it in so many ways, you know. Although I'm a safe character, I think that's why my partner chose me. She knew I would never violate that agreement, that sacred agreement. So let me just say that and leave it at that.
Yeah, I, you know, thank you for calling, and I'm wondering if there's a way in which you can reframe I'm put in the role of the perpetrator, and how can I become an ally? What is
it? Well, it's my plumbing. By virtue of my plumbing, I am on the other side of the equation.
But not all men are considered to be perpetrators. I mean, there is behavior that has to go along with that.
Right, but some wounds never heal. And for any woman that's been violated is in the process of healing, or hopefully, you know, she's learned the lesson of forgiveness. But that takes most of us a lifetime to learn that lesson. And I tell you, some wounds just never heal.
Are you saying that your partner has gone through this when she was younger?
Oh yeah, and many of my partners have. For some reason, that's all. I just kept attracting the wounded bird. Perchance because I've been wounded and I've been going through my own healing process.
Well, I think as Sherry said, try and reframe it as to be a partner in healing.
Because becoming an ally in this, and you used the word endemic, and I think it's true, the amount of violence in cultures is, for all of us, just unimaginable. Mm-hmm. So we are going to meet lots and lots of survivors. Understanding your own journey with that, surviving whatever it is you've survived, and then ally with other survivors is an incredible way to reframe this experience and then become part of the solution, which is to really understand with compassion, you know, all of the people involved.
Well, see, as I become an elder, I mean, I enter into this role of protector. You know, I don't want to be some lecherous old man, despite the fact that I'm still attracted to beautiful women. And so I have just naturally, and by virtue of the fact that I have this beautiful daughter that I would, you know, protect, you know, like one of my girlfriends said, she wished her parents had protected her virginity more. Okay, and or in a better way, or I forget what the final adjective or two that she added to that. But when she said that to me, I realized I better step up because my daughter was 13 or 14 at the time and just about to come of age. And, you know, my daughter's got, she's gotten a good dose of right action and how to respect herself. And so I don't worry about her in that regard. So much as maybe this young lady wasn't quite so guided or cared for, you know.
Just keep the communication open with you and your daughter and always be open to whatever she's experiencing, and it sounds like you're on the right path.
Yeah, I hope so, because, you know, I don't see her getting in trouble in that regard, but just having been through as many relationships where the women have been deeply wounded by something that is, I mean, come on, sex is the best thing on the menu, and not to be able to enjoy it anymore or to trust anybody ever again or to be vulnerable, I mean, that kind of queers the deal, you know? And I don't mean to use that word in the wrong sense, but I think I used it properly.
All right, well, thank you so much for calling. I do appreciate
that. You're welcome.
All right. And again, the number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. Or toll-free for Southern Humboldt, 923-7799. Which brings up an interesting thing. One thing that, Don, that you talked about was that you have found that after going through something like this, that the two directions that you saw women take were either they were just afraid to be touched, you know, just pull away from any kind of sexual contact, or become very sexually active and promiscuous.
Well, let's not use the P word.
Okay.
Just extremely sexually active.
Extremely sexually active.
Well, I think it's because if you choose the path of becoming extremely sexual active, you're trying to prove that you still are capable of being sexually active. The other sense of it is that you're, if you choose to pull completely away, you still are afflicted with not being able to trust. And, you know, it took, I've had a little bit of both paths. So, you know, when I was in my very young adult years, although I still had, you know, I hadn't been with somebody until I was almost 17 in that respect. But, you know, so, yeah, I was trying to prove. And then I had an enlightenment that, well, maybe that wasn't the way that I was going to heal from this. So then I, you know, then I chose to, you know, pull away from it that way. And just... And you've got to understand that the times, just to give you an idea, I'm 51 years old. So this was at the time when I was working, and almost all the careers that I was in were male dominated. And it was at a time before there was, you know, in the workplace, what was inappropriate. So I can't tell you how many men would pat me on my butt or wrap their arms around me or, you know, whatever. And that, you know, that was a little discerning, you know, especially coming from the background that I had,
sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, and then to have, you know, my male bosses say things to me like, why are you working? Why don't you just find a man and get married? You know, like that was going to solve all the problems, you know, because that was the right path to go on. So each person is affected differently and each person is going to go on, you know, find their own path to whatever. Some may touch on all of it before they find the right one to get back into, you know, the balance of it.
And I think both of those journeys of being extremely sexually engaged with a lot of different people and shutting down and not wanting to be with people, both of those are an attempt to be in control of your own sexuality because you have not had control over your body and your engagement with other people. And so both of these are effective methods of putting you back in control of your body, whether you're choosing a whole bunch of people and a whole bunch of alternative lifestyles, or if you are detaching from sexual activity completely.
And I appreciate what Don said, that changes for people at different points in their lives. But yeah, I agree with Tasha that it's all about regaining control. I also wanted, in response to the caller, we haven't named clearly, so I just want to name clearly that many boys are also subjected to child sexual abuse and incest specifically. And certainly that while the majority of perpetrators are men, which doesn't mean most men are perpetrators, but the majority of those harming children are men, there are certainly many female perpetrators. So I think that it's important that this isn't about there's a good gender and a bad gender. Gender is very beautifully complicated. There's more than two. Perpetrators come from across the spectrum. And there are some very specific gendered issues going on that have to do with our whole society and all the issues Don just raised about treatment of women in general and all of that. But just to be clear that children of all genders are being subjected to sexual abuse.
And it's a lot more common than people think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
It's one of the biggest kept secrets.
It's horrifically common, unfortunately. It's and as Don just said, it's a secret. You know, it remains a secret for so many people for sometimes forever.
It might help listeners to know that the official statistics are about 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 8 boys are survivors of sexual abuse. So that's your neighbors, your classmates, your friends, people at work. You know a lot of people who have been through this, and you may have been through this as well. And remember, for all those who report, who are in the statistics, there's a lot of people who live the secret, as Dawn was talking about. So anyone who's listening, know that you're not alone, and it's all around you, and everybody can be part of the solution and part of the healing.
Let's repeat those statistics. 1 in 3
girls and 1 in 8 boys.
That's a tremendously huge number.
Yeah. So when the caller said endemic,
it truly is.
And keeping that in mind, that there may be people out there feeling isolated with this, I'd like to give our hotline number again.
Yes, please
do. Which is 707-445-2881. And our role on that hotline, which is available 24 hours a day, is to listen, believe, support. We're not there to tell anyone what to do or think or feel, but to try to create a safe space for them to manifest their healing.
You can call at any age and at any time.
Any age, and no matter when the violence happened. And we do hear from children on our hotline as well as teens and adults. And we might hear from somebody who was hurt today, or we might hear from somebody who was hurt 50 years ago. And all of those people are welcome to call us, as well as those who love them, significant others in their lives who want to know how to be that ally.
That's actually a really good point.
Yeah.
About, you know, a friend who's gone through this, you know, what do I do?
Absolutely. And, you know, as Sherry was mentioning to the caller, to becoming an ally. So sometimes people call us to do just that.
Absolutely. Because sometimes, you know, we don't have the tools or we don't have the knowledge of how are we supposed to be supportive.
Right.
Yes.
Also, if you're too afraid to maybe call in because you're afraid your voice is going to be recognized, or you just don't have maybe the courage to call in and speak to one of us, Cliff, you have an email that they can email their question or their comment, and we can read it without giving your name or anything, and then we can respond to that for you.
Right. That is studio@khum.com. Very easy. studio@khum.com. We also have a letter that was emailed to us very generously by someone who's gone through this, and at the end of it, rather than saying, please don't give my name, says, if you're going to read this, please give my name.
Should we do that after a break?
Let's do that. We're going to take a very quick break. You've got it on KHUM. It's our 16th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign on KHUM. And it is 18 minutes after 9 o'clock. We're in the home stretch of our roundtable discussion dealing with the topic of incest. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, our 16th here on KHUM. And the first time that we're actually dealing with this topic in specificity, dealing with incest. And knowing the statistics, it's certainly about time we did. So, Sherry, you've got the letter. We got a letter from a listener, Katrina, I believe.
Yes, that's her name, and she wanted us to use her name. She says, good morning, Cliff. Thanks again so much for your series on incest. I would love to call in and speak, but will be unavailable and would like to write my 2 cents worth instead in case you have time. When a child suffers any form of repeated abuse, their formative years are spent trying to make sense of the senseless. Instead of learning self-mastery, cooperation, problem-solving, and other useful skills, children learn that bizarre behaviors are acceptable. They learn that loved ones hold ultimate power over them, that self is only an object for someone else, and many more warped ideas about how the world works. So when we become independent adults, we lack the social skills necessary to maintain the pace of our peers. Our most often, we don't even know what we are lacking in these basic skills, especially if no one ever told us what was going on was crazy wrong, which unfortunately is all too common. As a group of friends get together to share their week, maybe over a beer, they bounce things off each other like problems with their bosses, their in-laws, neighbors, and the like. This connection is a healthy community, and each member benefits. I believe that because survivor stories are so shocking to non-survivors, most of us don't share with a non-survivor friends in the same way. This thought, after listening to the first 3 days of this series, made me realize how important it is to find, if not a group, at least one other survivor to befriend so that there is a healthy outlet for the bouncing of stories of each other for support and healing. I have dear non-survivor friends who have offered to be ears and listen, but as I begin to tell just one story, I can see the pain in their faces and I can't go on. Mm-hmm. I am 55 years old and just completed my dream of going of a college education at HSU. While there, I learned about a survivor's group on campus and joined. It was the first time I could openly discuss any detail about my abuse and knew that I wouldn't be abusing anyone else with my tales of torture. It was the most remarkable leap in healing I've made, and highly recommend to any survivor, if they have not yet done so, to find at least one survivor that they can talk to anytime, a friend in kind. It is a real gift that we can give to one another to have a buddy who really gets it. As for those, fortunately few, but still too many, who don't understand and say things like, "That was then, this is now, get over it," I'd like to ask them if they would ask a war veteran who suffers PTSD to get over it. Once you've experienced trauma, it stays with you for life. We have been hardwired incorrectly and must overcome incredible odds to first locate and then attempt to rewire the horrors that were built into our foundations. Thank you, Cliff, and thank you, Kay Hum, and everyone who contributes to this awesome series about us, the Forgotten Children. Katrina.
Fantastic.
Beautiful. I got a special email from her as well after my speak, and I just want to say that you have a lot of courage too. So keep moving forward, and keep finding other people to just reaching out and being able to just touch one person's life. If one person mm-hmm. gets the opportunity to get something from this, to move forward, to just at least acknowledge and know that they're not alone. I think that's the hardest part. You do tend to keep a lot more to yourself because you know you're different. You know you've got things that like she said, people don't they want to be there for you, but they don't want to hear what you've been through. It's horrifying to think about it.
And I think there's a reluctance on a lot of our parts that if we told you what happened to us, we would traumatize you.
Yeah.
And so then we live in silence, and that it's reinforced that what happened was so bad that it just upsets people to hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Or that maybe that person won't like us anymore, or they'll think that now we're damaged goods, right, or we're not the person they thought we were.
Yeah, I love those terms too. You're damaged goods. You have baggage. Those are always fun things to hear about yourself.
We all have baggage, people.
Geez, thank you. but the thing is, one of the things I've learned in many of the classes I've taken is, stop labeling things. Mm-hmm. You don't need to label it. It doesn't require a label.
Right. And I want to say that one of the services that we offer at the North Coast Rape Crisis Team are support groups for survivors. And a lot of people, and it's not necessarily for everyone. Some people do better in individual therapy or in lots of other ways that they might be working on their healing.
Everyone's different.
Yeah. But for a lot of people, coming together, and as Katrina shared in her letter, to be with other survivors and hear their stories. And for some people, they can offer compassion to that other person in the group before they can mm-hmm. offer the compassion to themselves. And it's for many people, it really is a supportive and important thing that they can do for themselves. So,
well, absolutely. And, one of the things that I hear from so many people of various different kinds of violence, domestic violence, this kind of thing, is that they kind of feel alone mm-hmm. and that they were what happened to them was rather unique. Right. And when we just found out the statistics, there are actually more women who have gone through this kind of sexual abuse as children than there are women with blue eyes. which is,
and I have blue eyes. So.
You got the double whammy. The
other thing that I'd like to offer is if you don't feel that you can be a part of a support group or something, think of it in another way. Think of it as this. If you still feel that you are a victim instead of being a survivor, getting out of your own head and helping another person and then allowing will also help you. When you can get out of your own head and be helpful to someone else, you'd be surprised how helpful that is actually to yourself as well. So it's like you get a 2-for-1 in the healing process or the recovery process or the becoming a survivor process.
And I just want to put in a plug for the healing breakfast and the emphasis on healing. And that's the opportunity for all of us on November 18th at the Warfringer from 8 to 10 to come and just be in the room, just be in the same room, whether you decide to speak or not, or just get some information from the North Coast Rape Crisis Team or any of the other information tables that will be available. It will be our time to just be together.
Yeah, there will be a lot of information tables in that room. Aside from a lot of yummy pastries from Valentini Baking Company,
gorgeous view.
That's a great reason to show up. There'll be music and just a lot of good discussion
and an inspirational keynote speaker.
Wow, I know. I'm just so excited that we are going to be getting Carolyn Lehman as our keynote speaker. And basically, she was very excited to do this because she's like, "This is great because I've got some new information I want to share." And then the extra gift is that she's going through some serious health problems right now, and is willing to do this despite
and
all that.
She's the author of Brave
at the Heart.
At the Heart,
yes, it's
which
an amazing
you think
book.
I can't read this book? I can't. But you can, and if you do, you will really be empowered. And healed. And it's just a series of really beautiful stories. There's also another book called The Courage to Heal. So you can Google that. And even if you can't talk to anybody and you don't want to just even begin to look at the process of understanding this, just sometimes reading other people's stories, it really can be a tremendously helpful first start.
And one of the books that I read, I was not a survivor of sexual abuse, but of other kinds of trauma. And one of the books that really changed my life was called Legacy of the Heart, The Spiritual Advantages of a Traumatic Childhood. I can't remember the author, but it's a very interesting way to reframe what happened to you and realize the spiritual advantages traumatized people often have and the deep understanding of humanity and resilience that they gain from what's happened to them.
Thank you.
Can we also get, like, maybe we can pull those books together and you can post them on the website for people who might want to.
Yeah.
Great idea.
We should put a list of those because they are terrific. Yeah, you know, Strong in the Heart, you know, that one I've seen, and it's an extraordinary book.
I really appreciate Tasha sharing that particular book title. I haven't read it, but I'd love to. But because something we witness all the time is that people who've come through traumatic events often have such a reservoir of compassion and spirituality expressed in many, many different ways, whatever that means to different people. So what gets thought about people who've been hurt is that they're wrecked and ruined. And I find myself often wanting to say to the public at large, these children who are hurt are not wrecked and they're not ruined. They're still the whole beautiful beings that they were born to be, and the essence of who they are, regardless of what may be appearing on the outside of them at some given point, whether a child or an adult who's struggling, that essence is still there, and the self-discovery of that is a magnificent thing to be able to witness.
Absolutely.
And we might have to go through layers. The coping strategies that are well documented in the Adverse Childhood Experiences study by Vincent Felitti is there's the role of alcohol and other drugs in self-medicating a lot of trauma from childhood is so clearly there. And then there are consequences of doing that and other kinds of coping behaviors. So sometimes you have to get through the layers of those things, having coped that way, to where the core is. Mm-hmm. And the belief initially is that the core has been damaged. And to get through that part, to get to the other part, is really the worthwhile journey.
Right, because it's the opposite of the core being damaged. It's it's all these layers of junk that gets kind of accumulated as one is trying to survive.
So let me give out the phone numbers again if you want to call in and be part of this community dialogue. We've got less than a half hour left. It is 786-KHUM. That translates to 786-5486. Toll free for Southern Humboldt, 923-7799. And to email a question or comment or thought in studio@khum.com.
And just to remind everyone, too, that if you go to the Stop the Violence little logo on the KHUM website, there is an interactive resource opportunity. So even if you don't want to call and you don't want to read and you don't want to do anything.
We do have someone calling
like
right now.
Okay.
So let's go to the phones. Hello, you are on the air on KHUM.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I'm really glad that you guys are talking about this at all, because I heard you say the other day that this is often an uncomfortable topic, and I think that those are sadly the ones that need to be discussed the most.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean, this is we've been doing this campaign for 16 years. The first time we've taken this particular topic on, I mean, it's been talked about before, but this is the first time we've focused a full week on it.
And this is going to sound possibly a little bit strange, but I was wondering if the Rape Crisis team or any of you guys there did any work with perpetrators or potential perpetrators of these crimes.
Well, at Rape Crisis, we don't claim specific expertise and don't have funding to directly work with perpetrators, although sometimes survivors are perpetrators and we may or may not know that. But a resource that I really recommend here locally, there's a wonderful therapist. Her name is Gail Nearham. She's worked very closely with Rape Crisis for many, many years. And she works with not only those who are court-ordered into treatment for sex offenders, but for anybody who is struggling with behaviors or beliefs within themselves that might lead to acting out in some sexually inappropriate way. And she works with survivors and offenders. And
how do you spell her last name?
N, like Nancy, A-R-U-M, Gail Nearham. And her agency or business is Nearham and Associates. And I really recommend her as a resource here locally.
And Sherry, what about MEND or WEND?
Just a minute, caller. MEND WEND is also a resource in terms of the connection between domestic violence and then some other kinds of behaviors that men and women might want to really look at in group. So MEND WEND is another possible.
And they also have their CAP program, which they have people who've been court ordered into their program for child abuse, child maltreatment, including neglect. However, they attempt not to have sex offenders in that particular group. But if there are other kinds of child abuse issues going on, that they would be a good resource for that.
And then, caller, were you going to say something else?
Oh, yeah, it's seems a little bit hokey in my mind, but I still think it's true. I'm glad to hear that. I just think that whatever healing can be a process approach from both sides, whenever possible, it's a good thing.
Right, right. And I really, really appreciate you bringing this up, because it's something I wanted to address kind of earlier on, and it's kind of hard to segue back to it, so this is perfect, is sort of the rationalization that people who do commit these kinds of acts talk to themselves about, that they want to introduce the child to lovemaking in a special way, other kinds of, like, it's better for this to happen from this person than somebody, a stranger. And so it's really important to get some of that stuff out and talk to somebody who can help you reframe those things to understand that as an adult, you never have the right to do that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. And again, the number is 786-KHUM at 786-5486. Toll free for Southern Humboldt, 923-7799. That is the number. And actually, we have to, a little bit behind, I got to take a quick break. But we've got a little bit of time left, so if you want to make a call, this would definitely be the time to do so. Ah, it is time. We are back. You've got it on KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We're in the last 20 minutes of our two-hour roundtable discussion, and it looks like we've got someone who is calling in right now, so we will take that call. Hello, you're live on the air on KHUM.
Yeah, I'm calling about the incest.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that my mother was an incest survivor, as was my sister an incest survivor, and the impact it had on the family was just awful.
Wow. Are you an older or younger sibling?
I was a younger sibling. When my sister wasn't being molested, I was being spanked with a razor strap, I guess.
Was that in order to keep you quiet about it?
No, it was just the way my dad was. He was a volatile person. And, you know, when he lost his temper, she was either going to get molested or I was going to get a whooping.
A beating.
I don't know what else to call it.
A beating. That's what you call it.
Did he use alcohol?
No. No, he used no alcohol. He was a hardworking, respected man of the community, any community we were in. People thought the world of him, but they didn't know this.
Right.
And my sister passed away recently, and most of her problems stem from the molestation. Mm-hmm. She married a man who also was a sexual predator.
Right.
And is serving prison time. It just amazes me how this stuff just continues and continues.
You know, I'm glad
and
that
mostly because nobody talks about it.
Very true. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think that's a very key component of the whole thing of being a survivor or a victim of sexual abuse, that it affects the whole family. My mom, you know, because her children were molested, is still to this day at 72, 73 years old, is still affected. She's never remarried. She can't stand to be touched. That guilt goes with her. I mean, and she'll probably take it to her grave. And it does. It affects the whole family. Consequently, the whole family becomes victims of this disease, if you will, for lack of better wording. And the family needs to heal together, because it also creates a disconnect from your family. A lot of times the core family, because they're all victims and are all dealing with their own ways and don't realize that they're also victims, become disconnected from each other.
Well, my sister and I eventually talked about this with one another and, continued up until she passed away. For her and I, it was I felt like a great healing thing for her and I to be able to discuss it. And she would remind me of things that I had forgotten about, and I would remind her of things that she had forgotten about. But once we started talking, it just was amazing, you know.
Did the sexual abuse only occur to her, or did it happen to you as well?
Well, there was inappropriate sexual behavior, kind of on both parts, you know. Without going into detail, it was not so much I was being molested, but my sister was being molested in front of me.
Got it.
Which is a victimization of you.
Sure it is.
And
yeah.
I appreciate you naming also the physical violence that you were experiencing, because a lot of times that person in the family who is acting out against anyone else in that family group, it's not unusual that your father was acting out against both you and your sister, but in different ways. And sometimes that sets up a lot of separation between the siblings. And I'm really glad to hear and appreciate your sharing that you and your sister were able to do some healing together towards the end of her life, and I'm sorry for your loss.
While this was going on, did your mother know about it? Did she ever have an inkling what was going on?
Well, of course she did. She was molested as a girl, and she ended up running away from home. They found her. They put her in a women's for runaway kids back then. And so when she did find out, though, she worked on putting a stop to it, as nothing ends really fast. And I felt like things started getting better after that. You know, I'm not sure how, because the damage was done, but it did stop, I do believe, as my sister reported to me. And I don't know.
Where do you find yourself now in your healing process? With you know, to use the word healing, because there's not a there isn't another word to use. Although that I liked in the letter how that's really not exactly maybe the appropriate word, but the only word that we have at this moment to use. Where do you find yourself? Because clearly you were also a victim, and I got to tell you, it warms my heart to hear you say that you and your sister had this connection, because that's beautiful.
I don't know where I'm at right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've taken a really important step by sharing your story with all of us here and who are listening.
Have you had therapy at this point? Have you?
Yeah, I've gone to counseling in my life, and it helped a great bit, but I can't say it was really specific for that. It did come out stuff, but, you know.
Yeah, it might be good to actually deal specifically with this, because it's such a huge thing to have happened in your life. And just the fact that you're calling in right now and talking about it will help. But you're also giving a big gift to the community and helping those who are listening who have been through something similar to this, who are thinking, I thought I was the only one.
So, Paula, he would be able to call the crisis line and talk with someone?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've talk with people fairly often who witnessed someone in their family being sexually abused, and their experience that many of them share of the helplessness that they felt in that situation, and the victimization that they felt, but sometimes feeling like it's not okay to name I was hurt too because of their love and care for the person who was directly being sexually abused, and not wanting to try to say that it was the same. But I think it's really important that trauma can't really be measured. Its effects on each individual are whatever they are. And certainly for a child to witness somebody, their sibling that they love, being harmed in that way, is very traumatic, and he certainly would be welcome to talk with us.
And again, that number is area code 707-445-2881.
And I also want to say that to the community, all of us as community members, the more that we're willing to know about these things and be open, then there are more pathways than a hotline or a counselor or therapy or those things, which I'm glad that we have those things. But, you know, neighbors and friends and family members who can be there and hear the truth. You know, that's about a community healing, so that maybe someday there won't be so many people affected by this.
By being forced to, I guess, witness this abuse of your sister, did it have an impact on your personal love life moving forward?
Did or not. Boy, that's something I'd have to examine. I don't think so.
That's a big question.
Yeah. Because I know
it's certainly complicated.
It's a complicated question. Okay. Because, you know, clearly
the women who go through this, it does generally have some kind of effect one way or the other. I was curious about men who have to witness their sisters being abused. It's a terrible thing for you to have gone through. And the fact that you're sharing this, or unfortunately, you know, for every person who calls in, there is, you know, hundreds who have similar stories who haven't. And it's a big share. So thank you for calling.
Yeah, and I want to say that we're all sending you out a big virtual hug. And no, really. And we're sorry for you and your sister.
Right.
I mean, really.
Right.
I don't think that people get told that. You know, I don't think that anybody comes up to you and say, hey, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I know that the person who was the abuser didn't say they're sorry, but there's those of us here who can say that for you, that we're sorry.
And thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome.
All righty. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah, that was something else. And, you know, this comes in so many different forms and permutations, and every time you think, well, you've heard everything, there's another way that it's, I mean, it's, you know, as, you know, human beings, you know, we are, you know, we can go in so many directions. We're so imaginative. We can create and, you know, make such beautiful things. But the flip side of that is that we're also capable of such horrific things as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
And then it's realizing that we have that capacity to make different choices. Even if we feel like we've been compelled to do different things in our life, that we have the power to make different choices, and we have the power not to hurt others, no matter how much we've been hurt.
And I think the hardest thing to learn is that you need to love yourself enough to want to make a different choice. You need to love yourself enough to want to be a survivor, and to regain your power. And I mean, you are worth it. No matter what somebody told you, no matter what they did to you, you have the right, and you deserve. You are worth it. So take the time for yourself to heal.
Mm-hmm. And one caller mentioned forgiveness, but probably the biggest forgiveness that has to be done is for yourself. Because so often, and you know, I've been told this by so many people, the victims of the abuse feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow it's their fault. They've done something to bring it on.
And the forgiveness comes from also the fact that your perpetrator, whoever that person is, 99.9% of the time is not going to come back to you and say they're sorry. You know, both my father and grandfather are dead. They went to their graves with their secret, so to speak. So you need to be at a place where you can do the forgiving for them and for you.
And I guess for me, forgiveness is a really heavily laden word. It means a lot of different things. For some people, it has really strong religious connotations. For other people, not. I think of it as kind of a letting go. And I just want to say to any survivors out there, there's no requirement or edict or judgment. And as Dawn said, since the perpetrators usually are not seeking forgiveness, that's one kind of thing of whether you decide to forgive them that debt, whether they seek it or not. And that's up to each individual. But I want to say that whatever that means to you, and if it's something that creates a positive energy in yourself and something that feels healing and that relieves or lets go of something, then I think that's great. But if it's like, I would caution people against feeling bad about themselves because somebody else has said, and I'm not saying that's what was said here, but
sure,
out there in the world, people will kind of make it like you have to forgive, and it's like, well, excuse me, but actually,
yeah,
maybe I don't.
Yeah, well, I completely agree. I completely agree with you.
I think I think for me, that when I say forgive, it's like I want to forgive myself for believing that I wasn't good enough or that I didn't deserve to be a survivor.
Absolutely.
Sure. Which sounds really empowering. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Paul, you make a really valid point, you know, about forgiveness. You know, there was a lot of stuff I looked at, you know, involving the Holocaust, you know, and some people feeling empowered by, you know, forgiving and letting it go. If I couldn't, I mean, it all depends on your personal makeup. You know, I couldn't do that. I would feel I'd be betraying myself. Mm-hmm. If I was to do that, so it's a personal choice with something like that. But as far as forgiving yourself, forgiving yourself is a different thing because it was not ever your fault ever.
The acts are unforgivable. Mm-hmm. The acts themselves are unforgivable, and what we choose to do around our embodying these experiences and understanding these experiences, then it is choice. And then there is the power to choose to reframe what has happened. And really thank Tasha for that resource for that.
And we
book.
Do have someone calling in. We are running
really
out of time,
quick.
So let's make this a quick call. Hello, you are on the air on KHUM.
Good
Hello?
Morning.
Yes.
My name's Halsey, and I was actually given a call. First of all, I wanted to say a huge thank you to all of the speakers. I've listen to this every day this week on my way home from dropping my son off to school. And very, very brave, very, very good stories. But I had a quick question and one, I guess, kind of a clarification
yes.
about some statements that were made. My one question is there was a statement made that this is a choice that men make. And I think it'd be really important to address the idea that women also do this. I know that the numbers are not as drastic, but they do it too.
Yeah, we did mention that.
Oh, I must have missed it. I apologize.
That's okay.
And my other really quick statement was actually to you, Cliff. I feel the same way. I don't think I could forgive somebody for doing this to, well, if it happened to me or a family member, I really don't think I could, but no one should have to feel bad about this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And thank you very much, and have a good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for calling.
Appreciate that. Yeah, the numbers are, and as you said, you know, are vastly more men are perpetrators than women, but women do. It is absolutely absolutely true, and that goes with all forms of violence. You know, even domestic violence it can go that direction.
And some people have a hard time hearing that women can be perpetrators, for one thing, because of the kind of expectation of women as nurturer. And so it is important to be willing to hear those stories.
Yeah. All right. We are pretty much out of time at this point. I want to remind folks that next week our campaign continues. We are going to be dealing with violence in the lives of youth. And we've got, let's quickly run down the campaign because we're out of time.
Right.
So first off, we're going to be starting off on Tuesday the 8th, dealing with cyberbullying and self-esteem. You know, this is a very important thing. It's been on the news a lot as well. Why don't you just expand on that a little?
And just in terms of the suicides that have happened around youth being tormented via the internet, and we'll have with us, with Cliff, Dr. Karen North from USC, who is a very active and famous person who's consenting to be interviewed again, again.
That is right. She has been. She has a master's program in internet communities at USC. Has been on CNN and all these things. She's been very busy lately. And for full disclosure, is my sister-in-law.
we're so happy that she helps us.
Indeed.
And then on November 9th, Wednesday, Rochelle Trottenberg and two youth from the county's traditional age youth collaborative, and these folks are just amazing in helping to understand what it is that they really need in order to transition from foster care to adulthood.
That's right. Then on Thursday the 10th, it's going to be Nicole, is it Gans?
Gans.
Okay. Six Rivers Planned Parenthood Education Director. And
she's bringing a youth. Mm-hmm. Yes, she is. And then we'll have a panel next Friday, minus Paula, who's going to take a holiday. Otherwise, she'd be sitting here again.
Thank you very much.
And Susan Willen, retired director of the Children's Development Lab at HSU, Don Watkins from Humboldt Domestic Violence Services, and then Sarah Isaacs Mayers, who is a survivor of the foster care system, and she's going to be joining us on the panel, and Meg Walkley, who is the coordinator of the Child Abuse Prevention Coordinating Council and also works with First Five and is called OMI to the people in the community that she works with.
It should be an excellent week. The third week, we'll be dealing with survivor strengths, tools, and strategies, and of course, wrapping up with that healing breakfast
on November 18th at the Warvinger, 8 to 10 a.m.
Free to the public. Please show. Right. Be part of the crowd.
Right. Don, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. It was just amazing to have your voice. And then Paula, always a regular panelist and community treasure. And Dr. Howe, thank you so much.
Indeed.
My pleasure.
Indeed. And we're going to take a break, and we will hand it over to Mike next. You've got it on KHUM.